Attempted suicide is something we don't talk about, hard to get statistics, but I can tell you that the experience here in Australia, and I think it wouldn't be much different from many other countries, that for every actual suicide there are probably 20 attempts. If we look at depression, while we're talking on that subject, it's one of the most common mental disorders. There are 350 million people worldwide that suffer from depression. In developed countries, that normally is regarded as being around about 1 in 5, or 20% of people at any one time are suffering some form of high anxiety or depression. The leading cause of disability worldwide, depression is, and it's a major contributor to disease. More women are affected by depression than men, but as a tribute to women, they seem to be able to deal with that without going to the next step, which is suicide. There are, of course, effective treatments for depression, and I'm sure the next two speakers will be able to deal with those for you. I'm a great student of a person called Hugh Mackay, who's an Australian psychologist and writer, and he wrote a book, What Makes Us Tick, and in that book he said, the brain is really a computer, it's not a computer, but rather a gland awash with hormones. And he said, the evidence suggests that we are basically irrational creatures, but with careful training and discipline, we are quite capable of remarkable guests of bursts of rational behaviour. Mr. Mackay came up with these particular desires that people have, and he came up with 10. And the denial of one or more of these can, and these sometimes are contesting needs, can lead to depression. So here they are, the desire to be taken seriously. We all want to be needed and noticed and appreciated. The desire for my place. We all have a place that is special for us. The desire to believe in something. There's a major therapeutic effect from having a belief system, as opposed to somebody who's in a permanent state of scepticism. The desire to connect. Communication is our lifeblood. The desire to be useful. It's in our nature to be useful, and one of the great causes of depression is a sense of uselessness. The desire to belong, a sense of identity and emotional security. The desire for more. As a species, we tend to be insatiable. The desire for control. Losing control, it often causes neuroses. With the desire for something to happen, we always look forward to something, and the desire for love. When these desires compete, contradict, and collide with one another, this can impede our self-esteem and self-worth. During my time at Youth Focus, we came up with this particular triad as a sort of a mantra for us and a theory for dealing with young people. And basically the triad says the loss of self-esteem or self-worth can lead to a sense of people finding the world as a hostile environment. And if they stay in that position for a long time where they think the world around them is hostile, they get to the stage of what's the point. And our job was to get them to get back to that self-esteem level, to take charge of their lives again. And I used to look carefully on all the camps. We'd have 100 young people coming on a camp once a month. And I used to go and try and find the what's the pointers, because they were the ones that were most seriously at risk. There's a related theory also that is on this, which is developed by Dr. Thomas Joyner from the University of Texas in Dallas. This theory asserts that when someone holds two specific psychological states in their mind simultaneously and do this for a long enough period, they'll develop the desire for death. Self-preservation is no longer a powerful enough tool for them. There are intervention levels at three levels, really: population-based, community-based, and, of course, finally, treatment and work with individuals. These are the levels for countering depression and preventing suicide attempts. My experience at the Barefoot College in Rajasthan in India told me that the community engagement is one of the most effective ways of doing this. I worked there with illiterate women who in 6 months were turned into solar engineers and were going around the world solar electrifying villages. Worked with women's groups, rainwater harvesting, and all of these wonderful things. My experience of 4 years as the chair of the Ministerial Council also taught me that the community engagement is a very effective way and probably the only way of dealing with a lot of these issues. We established 55 community groups around the state, and these were community action plans that were designed, that they were driven and implemented by the people in the community themselves, and we provided just high-level governance and accountability. Before I left this role, I worked with the members of the council to produce a 10-year plan for mental health and suicide prevention in this state. Our belief statement sitting behind that is every life is precious and suicide is preventable. So we set ourselves the target within 10 years of halving the rate of suicide in this state, which at the moment sits at one person a day taking their own life. We came up then with 10... I just get myself ahead here. We came up with 10 targets that we set for ourselves, and the first one is... going back here. Greater public awareness and united action. Until you actually make the public aware of this and you bring this out into the light, as we've done in many, many cases, the problem simply won't go away. You need local support and community prevention across the whole lifespan. Preventing suicide requires a strong local approach and skilled suicide prevention coordinators and other particular agencies that can support. A coordinated and targeted services are also required for the high-risk groups, using evidence-based approach and using research such as the World Health Organization. The high-risk groups are the bereaved, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups, people with cultural and linguistic diverse backgrounds, the gay community, the people in the justice system, people who have already attempted suicide, the rural and remote areas of this state, and also people who are subjected to alcohol and drug abuse at any great scale. We need shared responsibility. Sometimes we seem to have the Commonwealth government doing one thing, the state government doing something else, and agencies doing something different. And so most suicides involve people in the workplace, and we believe healthy workplaces are an imperative way of dealing with this. A lot of stress is caused there, and people spend a lot of their time in the workplace. Training is an essential requirement. We need to upskill the community to increase their resilience and competence, particularly in talking and supporting people who show suicide ideation. And then finally, timely data and evidence to improve responses and services. Accurate data and statistics, I've found, are absolutely essential to target programs, and there's a dearth of really good statistics in many parts of the world. It leads to effective prevention programs complemented by up-to-date research and evaluation measures. The Australian Senate inquiry in 2010 came to this conclusion, and I'll let you read this. It is that last area where I believe a lot more work needs to be done, what is called postvention, in dealing with the bereaved. It is a massive problem. You think one life is lost, you think of the circle of people around that, and their needs, and quite often if their needs aren't met, it can lead to other suicides. Look, life is so precious, and we deserve to be to live a life of peace and harmony, of happiness. Happiness is to be shared. And if we fail to comprehend that during our lifetime, then some part of us really dies, as evidenced by the great Buddha. That's a very short picture of some of the things that are happening out in the community. We're given very limited time this morning, but I would be delighted to answer any questions on any of the material that I've raised here today. I've got just enough time to tell you a story about how I've seen this actually work with young people. During one camp with Youth Focus many years ago, there was a young man there who was at great risk of suicide because he'd been in the backyard with his brother and they were digging a hole while their parents were out shopping one Saturday morning. And they dug two holes, and as the two boys linked up underneath, the sand collapsed on the younger brother. And by the time they were able to dig him out, he was dead.
Yeah.
And this young man carried that grief for about 4 years, and he was in a pretty serious way. And this great outpouring, as I facilitated this session on bereavement with him, was coming out. Grief is a major issue for young people and often not dealt with well in the Western world.
Yeah.
And I could sense that somebody was moving around in the room, and I was really concerned about that because we had a rule when someone was speaking, no one moved. We paid full attention to the person who was actually speaking about their particular issue. You get so focused on the young person, I used to say, I'll give you a bit of my heart, if you let me have a little bit of yours, and we would lock in so that I could be emotionally attuned to this young man. But this person kept coming, and finally a young Aboriginal boy came into our picture, and he walked up to this young man and said, listen to these words, if you'll have me, I'll be your brother. And that was the most perfect closure for that particular. So working with young people, I think, is very important, and giving them that opportunity to learn and work with one another, to have a lived experience with one another, we can change a lot of things. We have to do a lot more with the young to deal with these terrible scourge of drugs and other things that are affecting their lives. I hope that little story gives you an indication how young people can take charge of their lives again. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. That was certainly an emotional story at the end there, and thanks for sharing that with us. Certainly put things into perspective for that young boy. Our next speaker is Dr. Chien Hung Gui. He is a clinical psychologist who works with adults experiencing anxiety disorders, phobias, panic and worry. He integrates best evidence-based treatments including cognitive behaviour therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy and mindfulness approaches. He helps clients identify, understand and break free from anxiety and fear through effective step-by-step strategies in a supportive and a caring manner. Please welcome Dr. Chien Hung Gui.
Morning, everyone. It's just such a fantastic conference, especially when we have got members of the Sangha from various different traditions. It's always wonderful to see practitioners and especially leaders and teachers of various Buddhist traditions come together in the same space. And also, we have members from other religions as well, representatives from there. I must say, though, for Buddhist conferences, I'm actually quite used to having a Buddha statue on the stage. But then for us, we got Skippy there. I think it's the organizer's way of reminding or inviting us to see the Buddha and the Dharma in every manifestation possible. So thank you for that. How many of you were here yesterday? Oh, wow. All right. How many of you are just here joining us today? Great. Welcome. Thank you. So today's session is really building upon what we've covered, the conference has covered yesterday with mindfulness and well-being. And really we're talking on the kind of the heavier end of the spectrum today. We're talking about suicide, talking about depression. And I must admit that I've been to various psychology and mental health conferences, and there's no conference that starts at Sunday cold morning, 8:15, talking straight about this topic. So I think the Buddhists, we have a certain resilience and courage to go straight into the hardest topics. I do want to acknowledge you all for coming, though, because I understand that some of you have a lot to travel, especially on a very cold Sunday morning, so thank you. What I'm going to do today is to expand a little bit more about depression and what we know about it, the types of treatment. In particular, spending a bit more time talking about how we prevent the relapse of depression. Depression is fairly common, right? And as Peter has covered earlier, in terms of the statistics, it's probably 1 in 5. And it's usually when it starts to recur again and again. And that's really what starts to drain an individual. When you have the first bout of depression, you recover from that, you have some stability. And then the second bout comes, and then the third bout comes. And that's when really life becomes quite intolerable, and the sense of hopelessness starts to really seep in. And let me define first depression, because sometimes there is a misunderstanding between feeling low down, as one would in day-to-day life, and confusing that with what we call clinical depression. And when we talk about depression here, we're talking about a prolonged period, typically about 2 weeks or more, whereby for a person, for most of the day and nearly all days, that they'll have a sense of low mood, experience of low mood, and loss of interest, and or a loss of interest in their day-to-day activities. This is also characterized by symptoms such as a change in appetite, weight, sleep patterns, also a sense of hopelessness, sense of guilt, thoughts about suicide, thoughts about death. Also, changes in terms of the concentration difficulties. And the main thing is that this is generating distress and is starting to impair a person's life. And when we look at depression, we typically look at this, and PL yesterday has covered this a little bit. There's mild, there's moderate, and the severe end of depression. And currently the evidence that we have is that with the severe end of depression, usually that medication is the best line of defense. And apart from that, there's also electroconvulsive therapy, ECT. And also right now, there's some development in something quite new, which is called transcranial magnetic stimulation. Instead of doing ECT, they use strong magnetic waves to actually kind of rejig the brain, so to speak, the brain chemicals. Now, when we're talking about the moderate and mild end of the spectrum, then the recommendations here is that you can either use antidepressants or psychological therapy. And of course, my background being a clinical psychologist, that's where my expertise come in. In terms of depression in the acute phase, that means someone who is actually having depression, usually it's the first line of defense in terms of psychological treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy. So in short, in very brief, essentially it focuses on two parts. First of all, the cognitions. That means identifying where are the biases and the stuckness in the thinking patterns. As any of you, even when you're feeling quite low, you tend to start to recognize that there are patterns of thinking that starts to go round and round. And there's a certain stuckness. The focus is on certain types of ideas about oneself, or idea about one's life, and the cognition, the thinking pattern is hooked onto that. And it's actually very difficult to have any clearer perspective. So part of the treatment is to help them gain a sense of flexibility to see the larger picture and not just focusing on that which is negative. So that's a cognitive component. The behavioral component typically is to help one increase the level of activity. When someone is depressed, typically the activity level is quite low. And it's helping them gradually build up, increasing the energy levels in their body, in their mind, doing it in a stepwise and systematic manner. So that's cognitive behavioral therapy. What I'm interested also is that once a person recovers from a bout of depression, when they're in remission, when they've recovered, then what's the next step? Typically, if you're on antidepressants, the recommendation is for you to continue on for a period of time, which is the maintenance dose. And the literature, we know that a lot of people don't tend to continue with this medication. That's why it was about 20 years ago there's starting to be research into, are there other psychological means that we can help people develop skills rather than just relying only on medication to be able to build more resilience in the mental and psychological level. And that's why the group in Oxford University and also with Toronto, they designed a program called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy. And how many of you are familiar with MBCT, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy? So quite a number of you. All right, great. And, of course, Venbo, Jinai's presentation yesterday also talked about something like it's like a course, right? It's a group program. Typically goes for 8 to 10 weeks, 2 hours each week, and also plus a one-day silent retreat. What they teach the participants is that how do you pay attention to internal experiences, the thoughts and feelings, some education about the patterns and risk factors that are associated with depression, and also developing an action plan in terms of when you notice this, what is the useful thing, what is a helpful way to move forward from this point. And based on years of research now, we've seen that the usual amount of a reduction in relapse, that means the rate of relapse, through a MBCT program, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy program, is able to reduce by about 30 to 40% reduction. And that's huge, right? That's clinically, that's huge. When 30 or 40 over percent of people are actually less likely to then go on to develop another bout of depression, this is actually a very fascinating finding. And in actually 2010, the researchers from Toronto and Hamilton in Canada actually then looked at why not we actually compare the findings from someone who is going through a maintenance dose of depression, that's the current gold standard, versus MBCT only. Right, what will we actually find? So they actually found that a group of about 160 people all have recovered from depression, all having a bit of 5 months or so of maintenance dose of antidepressant, just to make sure that they're actually really stable, right? They have actually fully recovered from the first bout. And in fact, these are the people who have had previously had more than two episodes of depression. Because in the MBCT literature, they find that the more past episodes of depression you've had, the more you benefit from this training. So the 160 people relatively recovered, stable, and then they randomly allocated them into three groups. First group, continue with antidepressant. Second group, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Third group, which is a placebo. That means they take a pill, but it doesn't have the active ingredient, right? Just as a comparison, as a control. And they followed up these people but in 18 months' time. And what they found was that the group with just placebo, that means no active ingredient in the medication, there was a certain rate of relapse. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and maintenance dose of depression had a joint reduction of 73% of the relapse risk. So this is huge, right? And they didn't find much difference between the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and the medication group. And this is really useful because if we know that people don't tend to take their medication afterwards in the long term as a maintenance dose, there is now possibly a new pathway. Now, for those of you who are considering this, I do encourage you to speak to your physicians, speak to whoever is prescribing your medication, and get proper training in terms of mindfulness-based intervention. But this is starting to look really promising. And for me as a clinical psychologist, what is also really useful for me to understand is actually what's going on. When we teach someone mindfulness-based strategies, what is actually going on? What is evoking the change? What's the actual mechanism of change? Now, there are various different processes that have been proposed. They talk about reduction in rumination, in thinking, the attentions get stronger, this and that. But there's particularly a few of them that I want to actually touch on. And one particular is this notion of meta-awareness. Meta is M-E-T-A, not our Buddhist loving-kindness meta. Drop the one T. So META, meta-awareness. And what it means is essentially the ability for one to recognize internal experiences, the thoughts, the feelings that we have, the ability to recognize those experiences as just passing phenomena. Meta means higher order, a level up. So meta-awareness means awareness of the internal processes, experiences, thoughts and feelings. And when someone has been trained in mindfulness-based meditation or practices, the meta-awareness just goes up. Now, this is a consistent finding that we've been seeing. Meta-awareness starts to go up. That means the person is able to relate internally with their experiences quite differently from someone without any training. Let me give you an example. When I tend to teach meditation courses in Sydney, when a participant or a student actually starts to report that they can differentiate between thinking, the state of thinking or feeling, a certain feeling, versus knowing that one is thinking and knowing that one is feeling, then you start to see that there's a shift. The meta-awareness has increased. Now, for meditators, this is like, yeah, that's like news from 2,500 years ago, right? Nothing new. But for science, that is fascinating because when you're actually having an experience and thinking, you're in it. When you have the ability to pay attention with internal experiences, you have this meta-awareness that means you're able to know that I'm thinking. You're able to know that I'm having currently this particular experience. This allows you to what we call decenter from the experience. And once one is able to do that, it starts to create space. Right? It starts to create a sense of stability in the mind. Because it doesn't necessarily mean what you think, what you feel is reality. There's an alternative to look at this as just passing phenomena. It's a bit like the weather. It rains today. And we know from our experience that it changes. One time it rains, there'll be sun, there'll be cold, there'll be hot. Right? Because of day-to-day knowing that weather changes, we are not overly affected by changing. But of course we say, oh, bummer, today is a gloomy day. But wait a few days, that was chiffed again. It's very similar to this experience of meta-awareness. When you've got meta-awareness, then you know the experiences change. You're not so drawn into it. And this is really useful because the model of why depression relapses is because when someone comes out of depression, you're more likely to go back into it because day-to-day life, we all have depressive experiences. You made a mistake. You think, oh, bummer, I made a mistake. Or sometimes you feel tired. Or for one reason or another, even physiologically, you feel that the mood is a bit low, the energy is a bit low. Right? For someone with multiple episodes of depression in the past, this can start to start a process of feeling a bit down. Oh, I made a mistake. Oh, I start to feel low. And I start to feel low about feeling low. And then it starts to snowball. Right? You feel bad. You feel bad about feeling bad. And it starts to then snowball in a loop. And then bang, the whole depression system is activated. The whole experience of depression starts to set in more and more. It's more global throughout the entire body, right? The entire sense of the world, right? I'm a failure. It goes from I've made one mistake to I'm a failure, I'm worthless, there's no point to actually live. Right? So you can see that from that process, it kind of snowballs. But with mindfulness and meta-awareness, it starts to cut it in the middle. You can have these experiences, you're like, okay, this is a thought. This is an experience, this is a feeling. And it doesn't necessarily then continue to snowball on to something else, or the depression. And you can see why meta-awareness and mindfulness training is able to do that. It allows us to just recognize it as it is. And this is very close to also what the Buddhist practice is also about, recognizing the reality of change, right? The shifting phenomena of physical and mental phenomena. So this is really where things are at right now in terms of the field, in terms of understanding what is potentially shifting when we look at mindfulness training for an individual. And of course, apart from this meta-awareness, there are accompanying qualities as well, such as patience that starts to develop, acceptance, and also increased awareness of positive experiences. We find that someone who is depressed or someone who is even highly anxious tends to not allow themselves to experience a lot of positive emotions. When they experience joy, they tend to shut it down. Right? Not just unpleasant feelings, but even positive feelings, there's a natural mechanism of shutting it down. With mindfulness training, it starts to open the mind's capacity to just sit with experiences, whether it's good, bad, or neutral. Right? Pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Right, it's a mouthful. It allows us to just recognize pleasant states, unpleasant states, or if you could go on to call it neutral states. So it opens the mind's capacity to be open to experiences as a whole. So hopefully what I've given you today is just some sense of where things are at in terms of the psychology of understanding depression, and more so importantly, understanding our relapse prevention in depression. That's a huge field for us to need to work on. And this is something that now we're starting to see that from a Western understanding and coming together the integration with the Eastern practices, in particular with mindfulness practice, is starting to give us hope. Because we know that when practiced well with mindfulness practice, we start to really recognize reality becoming clearer and clearer. It becomes clear as to what is to be discarded, what is to be developed, and what is to be perfected. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chien Fungui. He's also actually sharing his knowledge to plenty of university graduates or university students, I should say. He's the director of the training clinic at the University of New South Wales. So we'll be seeing plenty more future Dr. Chien Fungui's, I'm sure. So thank you very much for that. Our last speaker for this morning's session is Dr. N. Kong Tan. He's a medical doctor, consultant psychiatrist, and analytic psychotherapist. He is the founder of Meta Clinic, that's Meta with two T's, an established group of psychological practice in Pymble, Sydney. He's an adjunct professor at Nanteong Institute in Wollongong, New South Wales, and he is the founder president of the Australian Australian Association of Buddhist Counsellors and Psychotherapists. Please welcome Dr. Ing Hong Tan.
Thanks, Rachel. I just wanted to take a moment to take all of you in. The title of this session is, What's for Breakfast? I don't usually have depression and suicide for breakfast, but I congratulate you for having enjoyed your entree from Peter, the main dish from Chiang, and now I have the delightful job of giving you the dessert. I'll do my best to be short and sweet. Next slide. My take home for you simply about depression is it's common, it's treatable, and the sweetener is relapses are preventable. That's my take home message for you today. And this comes from 40 years of practice, seeing depressed patients 5 days a week. I want to take this opportunity to thank my patients well, to teach me how to help, and to be in a position today to have this opportunity to be in front of you, to share with you some of the things I've learned, actually, from my patients. So, Chiang has already very successfully covered this area. When patients are depressed, generally speaking, there are two types. There are those, and that's the majority, at least to start with. What shall I do? How can I get over it? I want to get back to work, and so on. Here is where cognitive behavior therapies come in. And as Chiang was saying, the breakthrough was from John Kabat-Zinn, who's an emeritus professor. He had the courage to bring in mindfulness to the clinical world. He simply stuck an advertisement in a Massachusetts hospital to say that whatever pain you're suffering and whatever treatment you're receiving, would you like to try meditation in case it helps? So guess what? He got the most difficult patients, intractable pain, severe depressions. And he simply asked them to put aside their symptoms for a while and just to learn mindfulness. And the results were amazing. And thanks to the pioneering work of John Kabat-Zinn, from MBCT, we have now got at least 15 types of mindfulness therapies, including acceptance and commitment therapy. When you look at it very deeply, it comes from the teachings of the Buddha. Mindfulness, as all of you would know, is 1/8 of the Eightfold Path. But the Buddha has very rightly put it as the centerpiece for treatment of all our suffering. And the Western world today, the world of medicine included, has appropriated mindfulness from the religious traditions. And by the way, mindfulness was there even before the Buddha. And it's again the genius of the man that has actually made it into a centerpiece in a form that's palatable, that's easily reached. And the success of mindfulness-based therapy today all over the world, in clinics, in hospitals, in outpatient clinics, is simply because mindfulness, meditation, is portable, it's free, you don't need to carry along any gadgets, and there's little or no side effects. It's as simple as that. That explains the efficacy and now the growing popularity of learning meditation. The next slide, by the time you're practicing for more than 10, 20 years, I get to see the more difficult patients. I get to see patients who've tried it all and are still severely depressed. And that is, these people usually by now are asking the deeper questions in life. Why me? How did it happen? I don't just want to get rid of the symptoms. I want to understand. And hopefully through the understanding, prevent. There was the old controversy, the old question about, is it nature? Was I just born with these genes and that's why? And from a Buddhist point of view, our acceptance of karma, our karmic seeds when we're born. Or is it nurture? Eric Kandel, neuropsychiatrist in the year 2000, settled this question and got the Nobel Prize. The answer is both. It's both. And now there's a whole new world of study called epigenesis. We might be born with the genes. Mommy, daddy, or uncle, or a grandpa might have depression. And there might even be a history of suicide in my family. But there are factors in our early life. And epigenesis is a study of how environment, how present factors can help or reduce the unfolding of certain genes. So, if we accept that, we now then have to go into an area of therapy to ask. And you will not be surprised that therapy is about, in long-term deep psychoanalytic therapy, is to help the patient feel safe enough to begin to speak the previously unspeakable, to bear with emotions previously unbearable. And it's because for the very severely depressed, there often is a history from way back of abuse, of shame, of neglect, of over-smothering, generally speaking, a lack of affection. And this predisposes to all sorts of personality problems. The severely anxious, the dependent, the obsessional, and there's also a category called the depressive personalities. So, we then start this long journey of once a week, twice a week, analytic therapy. Next slide. So, what are the Buddhist-influenced therapies today? The Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists, we now run a 2-year program of 10 weekends and 3 meditation retreats covering the 3 traditions to actually bring in the Buddhist teachings, in particular meditations, to train our psychotherapists who are already Buddhist inclined to actually make use of the Dhamma in an effective way, and today, evidence-based, thanks to a lot of research that helps our patients. When you look at the mindfulness-based therapies that Chien has so well enumerated, at the core of it, what is the therapeutic action? How does it actually work? Slowing down. Calmness. Acceptance in its full meaning. It's not resignation. It is not defeat. It's a simple Buddhist concept of suchness. Such is such. And in today's language, especially among young people, shit happens. The question is, can you understand? Like a trunk load of dung, as Ajahn would say. When you really understand that to be born, that to be back in samsara, what did you expect? But in a very respectful, very compassionate way. Acceptance. And diffusion was what Chian was talking about. We are not our thoughts. We are not our feelings. So when in mindfulness, when we can simply experience the arising and falling away of all phenomena, thoughts, feelings, sensations, we come to realize that we don't have to be the thought or to be the feeling. We're separate. And this too shall pass. This too shall pass. Like every breath. Like the arising and falling away of all phenomena. A central Buddhist teaching. Today I practice what is known as meditative psychotherapy. When my patients are ready and they've already learned mindfulness, I start each session, we usually have 50-minute sessions, with a mindfulness meditation together in 5 minutes. Then the patient talks, whatever. Usually it's a continuation of the last session. The patient leads me to the areas that needs to be shared with just another human being. Hopefully, in a joint wisdom and compassion that helps the whole process. At the end of the session, or 5 minutes before the end, I ask, which of these four meditations shall we do together now that would actually give us the healing? And my patients will choose. What would you guess of these four meditations? Which one would be the most popular? What would you guess? Is it those who are in favor of loving kindness? Would you put up your hands? Those of you who are in favor of compassion. Those of you who think that altruistic joy is needed. And those of you who think that equanimity is the basis of it all. Thank you. And you're absolutely right. It's about those proportions. Loving kindness takes it first. Simple loving, simple ordinary kindness does it. Next slide. So we've gone through depression. Remember to take the medications. As carers, we help to bring them to appointments. And I'm very glad that yesterday George Burns took us on the guided imagery. Simple things like returning to nature, exercise, yoga, tai chi, dancing, and of course meditation, and to keep the depressed person socialized. And to be able to say it's not your fault. I say to my depressed patients, depression happens to the best of people. You are the ones who are very hardworking, who have a high sense of responsibility, and who really do more than you should. That's why you get depression. If you're lazy, if you're a slob, there's no way you're going to get depression. And of course, we do not judge, we do not reprimand, we do not compare. Yeah, we've talked enough about suicide. The only thing I might highlight there is, remember to ask the person who's depressed, especially when you notice it's getting more and more severe. Are you already thinking about ending? Have you been thinking about reviewing your will? There is a common myth that by asking, we might actually introduce them to suicide. It's not true. All the depressed patients are actually relieved that someone finally has had the courage to ask. And if they're already suicidal, it's enormous relief to be able to share the suicidal thoughts, the plans, the strategy to end their life. And they do need someone to discuss it, and of course, to turn to life. And when someone is suicidal, we need to monitor, not just once, but for a long period. Because 15% of the world is depressed, and of the 15%, 15% of the 15% will kill themselves. It's all our job to do our best to maintain life. We will not leave the suicidal alone. We will not leave it to someone else to help. We will not leave it to chance. Next slide. This is the dessert, the sweetener. And I will end on this note. Thanks to Martin Seligman, who first wrote the book, Learned Helplessness. He learned how to be helpless from his depressed patient. And one morning he woke up. The blinding flash of the obvious went through his head. If I can write on learned helplessness, I should be able to write the opposite book, Learned Hopefulness. He started to study normal people, what makes them happy. And his first book, Authentic Happiness, that was his second book actually, was a bestseller. And his latest book is simply entitled Flourishing. So from this professor of psychology, who was the president of the American Psychological Association, in today's terms, when I help my patients, I do not just want to help them just to survive. I do not want to just help them to be able to try to live every day. I want to help them to fully potentiate, to flourish. And it's in the area of flourishing that is in fact the preventive work for depression. So very quickly, the positive emotions, the four S's. Can you sense right now how comfortable you are sitting in your chair in this air-conditioned room to actually be able to pick up what you've already taken for granted? That's very positive. Can you synthesize something in your mind that will bring a positive feeling? Usually, it comes out in terms of random acts of kindness, and we receive a lot of that in this conference. And to be able to express gratitude. Can we put our hands together for all the wonderful volunteers of this conference? An engagement. I really thank George Burns for taking us through a meditative exercise that got us so engaged. And Father Bob Maguire yesterday, the way he talked like an Aussie bloke, the way he drew us into his stories, it became timeless for us. We were all totally engaged with him at flow. And in terms of our relationships, we want to choose. The Buddha actually said to choose your friends, Kalyana Mitra. He was very wise because he knows time is limited. We want to choose relationships that offers that. The meaning, something, serving something bigger than ourselves. So crucial. An accomplishment, achieving something just for the sake of achieving. Whether it's learning a new language, whether it's playing the guitar, it's not for money, it's not for fame, it's just for a sense of achievement. We now know that this combination of these five elements actually helps the human condition to flourish. And when we are flourishing, there's little or no chance for depression. And finally, I'll leave you with further resources in the next slide, should you wish to chase them up. There are useful websites, Beyond Blue and the Black Dog Institute. And these are the five books I recommend all my patients. The Mindful Way Through Depression, Seligman's Authentic Happiness, Sharon Salzberg's book, Metta, Loving Kindness. Christine Neff came to Australia recently. The hardest person to be loving, to be kind towards, and to be compassionate towards is ourselves. Somehow, we can give it to others easily. We will actually find it difficult to give it to ourselves. Self-compassion, and very importantly too, awakening the joy in us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wing, and thank you for also mentioning the Black Dog Institute and Beyond Blue, because they're certainly very important institutes in Australia, so thank you for mentioning that. I know it has been a heavy session for a Sunday morning, but I'm sure plenty of people would take a lot of positives out of it too, and it's over to you all. If you would like to ask any of our speakers any questions this morning, we have two microphones just on the bottom of the staircase here and then two up the top there, so anyone who would like to come forward.
And so on. I work as a psychologist. But working against that is we're in a society where Peter Fitzpatrick mentioned that one of the outcomes in his inquiry was actually to work with government to improve mental health and well-being in workplaces. And currently we're working in a society. Australia ranks very highly in terms of expectation of overtime and often unpaid overtime. People are being young families, you know, who have mortgages are being sacked by email, and Saturdays and Sundays are slowly being turned into normal work days. So people are under enormous pressure, and I'm finding in my practice that a lot of my clients are presenting when they've been made redundant or with very poor management practices and so on. So I wanted to hear Peter particularly, how will you, what do you see happening that's going to counter what my friend and I yesterday, it's almost like a serfdom is being created for people in the workplace in terms of these expectations and lack of security really. What can be done to change what's happening.
Hello. Thank you for that that question. They say if you ask the right question, you can live with the answer. So hopefully I can give you something that you can take away. Mentally healthy workplaces are a critical factor right now. Beyond Blue has done a lot of work with this. If you go to their website, you can actually download a whole program that you can take straight to most workplaces in the land. Mental health first aid is being practiced in a lot of the workplaces now. For the last 5 years, we ran an agency arrangement where we accredited workplaces that were dealing with this effectively. It is a place, as I said in my presentation, of great stress, and we are concerned about that. We're now finding the better and the bigger companies are now paying as much attention to mental health and mental wellness in the workplace as they are to occupational health and safety, because the figures are now starting to show, and the World Health Organization says it will be the biggest epidemic in the workplace, far bigger than all the other causes of absenteeism, sickness and so on in the workplaces, is having mentally healthy workers. So there is work being done. The better workplaces are doing it. Getting it down to every level is a difficult task. Money has been set aside in the next 5 years in the state budget to do this. Beyond Blue works very much in this area. It's a matter of educating employers to set aside time and to train people in their workplaces in mental health first aid so they know to look for the signs, to ask the right questions. I hope that sort of answers the question. It's a work in progress, and in some cases it's not being practiced, but we have to keep plugging away till we get it right.
Thank you, Peter.
Hello. I've heard quite a few monks, including monks that we know in Australia, speak out against counselling and psychotherapy. They're quite opposed to it. What would you say to members of the Sangha who see a more secular-based process or the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or any interaction with counsellors and psychotherapists? What would you say to the Sangha who sees that as unnecessary and possibly counterproductive?
Thank you for your very challenging question. I think that speaks well of the Sangha members who asked that question, and they have the courage to ask. I simply say that we actually need both. I see Sangha members with depression. I help Sangha members in my clinic, free of charge. I use Medicare, by the way. It's not either or. Very often we need both. I think part of the criticisms of psychotherapy, especially long-term psychotherapy, which I think is a fair criticism, is that, you know, Ajahn would challenge me and Bhante Sujata would challenge me and Reverend Mahinda would challenge me to say, why do you take the patients back to their childhood and go through all that stuff again? Why do you? It's very simple. Because there are people who want to go back there, who need to go back there, who need just someone to sit with them, to peel the layers of the onion, to cry. And when we cry, as a Zen Buddhist would say, just cry. That's the need, the human connectedness. And then to have some understanding. And there are beautiful Ajahn moments, I would call them, in long-term psychotherapy, where my patient talks about initially a lot of anger for the abuser. And sometimes the abuser is the parent. And then the penny drops. The abuser was also once abused. There's an understanding of intergenerational transmission of trauma. That opens up the mind to dependent arising. Then we can bring in, without even using the word Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha in terms of codependent arising. So, my simple answer is, there are many roads to Rome, and we very often require more than one. Thank you for the challenge.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much for all the wonderful information and for, you know, all the guidance for so many of us that need to know. And also how wonderful that yoga and Tai Chi and other exercise was mentioned, because I'm a yoga teacher, Tai Chi and Qigong, and I see enormous benefits and happiness and joy from my classes. I specialise with seniors, and you know, it's just wonderful upliftment. My question today is that I've read research on technology, that technology especially affects young boys, and it leads to depression, and that addiction is a huge problem. So could you discuss that, please, any one of you?
Jim? Or Peter?
I do have a great concern about young people, particularly in technology, that it limits their ability to be a part of community, which is one of the great desires, of the 10 desires that I mentioned. I think it cuts people off from one another. People spend too much time alone, and accessing things they probably shouldn't be accessing. My concern for the next generation is that they actually break away from that and start communicating again in a more effective way, to get a sense of belonging that I think is missing with a lot of young people these days. We have to start with the young. I remember when I was the chair of OutCare, which looked after ex-offenders and their family to try and reintegrate them back into the community, and I found I wasn't getting very far. And my great friend and mentor, Sir Francis Burt, who was the Chief Justice at the time and later Governor of Western Australia, I went to him and said, I don't think I'm getting very far. And he said, well, don't look to me when they get to the courts. It's too late. So my suggestion is to you, Peter, is go and turn off the tap. And that was the founding of Youth Focus. And I believe getting young people relating to young people, they learn from one another. But you have to get them relating to one another. You have to get them talking. And if provided you can get someone that can start that conversation to get them going. I saw the learnings from that. I have young people who were drug addicts who have now got 3 degrees, people who had enormous self-esteem problems who are now school chaplains and so on. You can turn the tap on by getting that exposure to listening to one another, to finding out that what they're thinking is normal and that they can work with one another to charge up their lives again. I hope that's answered your question.
I'll just add a little bit on that. I think technology itself is neutral by nature, right? But there is also a fair bit of research right now that is suggesting that too much screen time when individuals are too young, children are too young, that's actually not useful. And one of the ways for us to look at this in a global scale is to see how we can try to reduce it and get the right sweet spot in terms of what's appropriate, because these children are growing into a generation where technology is something very crucial for them. But at the same time, the other side of it is this, the other side which is also happening right now is that we are using technology to then disseminate and reach those people that we didn't never used to be able to reach, whether they're young people, people in different areas. So I think this is neutral in essence, but at the same time it's knowing where to effect the change. Right, and I think in that regard, the field is moving forward with it, with the number of technology-based interventions that's increasingly available right now.
Thank you, Jen. Go up to the topic.
Hello, can you hear me? I'm just an ordinary mother who is going through a journey with a child, and it's very hard for me to talk, sorry. And my question is, from the doctor who told about the medication. And I want to ask about electrotherapy. Like I have a severely sick child. She's taking medication, and you told that mindfulness and medication two have to go together. And I'm trying my best to take her through that journey. And what is your advice for electrotherapy?
Thank you for the courage to share with us your great pain. You're already doing something that is intrinsically loving and caring for your child. You've come here today to ask for some more assistance. You are already on the right path. All I can say is, listen to the doctors. By the time psychiatrists, doctors today recommend electroconvulsive therapy, chances are the depression is of such severity that medications alone is insufficient. So the doctors have already given it a lot of due consideration. And may I reassure you and your child that today ECT is no longer given the way one flew over a cuckoo's nest. It's very safe now. There's very little side effects. And it's life-saving. We usually need a course of 6 ECTs for some, and then some repeated courses for others. I feel for you. May you be reduced in your suffering. May your child recover speedily. And if I can help you in any other way, let's meet at the tea break. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I have to share that the people who go through that and what you told, the Kalyana Mitra and Buddhism really, really help. It's very difficult for the child to bring to that mindfulness meditation or anything. But I have a Kalyana Mitra who is around, I think so. And we do our meditation and we help her to keep her focus, go through this journey. Decade of suffering, Buddhism helped me a lot. So I think I don't have words to say thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your very deep understanding of the first noble truth. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. This is not a question, but I would like to share, you know, my experience on how I deal with problems that come my way, the Buddhist way, okay? And maybe after that, the panel can give some comments, okay? Yeah. As a Buddhist, okay, yeah. I know that if I don't deal with problems that come my way, if I leave it too long, it will lead to anxiety, stress, depression, okay, yeah. So when problems come my way, okay, if it's a light problem, I do the normal mindfulness of my feelings, emotions, and it goes away.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Could I perhaps just add something to that? I do a presentation called The 10 Principles for Living a Fulfilled Life. One of those is always deal with the things you fear the most first, because if you don't, by the time you get back to them, they will be worse. So always head towards fear. It takes courage to do that. But I always say, too, that most of the things you fear will never happen. Fear is false expectations appearing real. That's what it stands for. But it's a great principle in life. What you fear the most is what you should deal with first. And I think that's where you started your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. We've only got a couple more minutes for more questions, so we'll try and race through it.
I have heard two different perspectives of the Buddhist perspective on suicide. One is that a Buddhist to commit suicide is bad karma. Now, this perspective comes from the belief that our first precept says we shall refrain from taking life, and that there cannot be an exception into that, saying it's all right, we have to refrain from taking all lives except your own life. So I think the expectation is that the first precept applies universally without exception. And the second reason that for that is perhaps that a person has to have a sort of hatred towards oneself at the moment of committing suicide, and that again causes bad karma. Now recently another view has been put forward that when one is born, one virtually has ownership of one's life and therefore has the freedom to do whatever one wants with one's life. And perhaps one argument for that is that there were instances when Buddha actually saw evidence of our acts of suicide but didn't comment. But I'm not sure if on every occasion the Buddha went and said, now that's a good act, that's a bad act. But anyway, this issue has been troubling me for some time, whether the former view can discourage suicide, whereas the latter view might tend to encourage suicide. So I'd like to have your comment on that, please.
I think it's important for us to recognize the value of life. Right, that's an important position to start off with. At the same time, when you're with anyone who is suicidal, I think it's very important for us to acknowledge where we're coming from and put our position at the time. It's more important to hear what's going on with the person in front of you or you're encountering who is experiencing suicidal ideation and intent. Sometimes in conversations, and clients tell me this, that it's hard to talk about suicide because the listener will very quickly dissuade them. Right? Doesn't quite allow them the space to work through what is actually occurring. That's why when I'm doing training of clinical psychologists, I typically get them to understand that a conversation with a suicidal client or patient is not me versus you and me trying to pull you to a certain direction. I will act, I will take action if needed. But really the conversation is between two individuals, like a park bench, and sitting and recognizing how the other person is seeing the world. Not because of how I see the world, I put that to the side for time being, and really understand what the perspective of that is. And when we can be a stable figure in providing that relationship and that space and that safety to explore it, then there is a real chance of evoking change deep down. And for that to happen, firstly, we need to be clear what our position is. And we vary quite differently. Even within the same Buddhist traditions, like you've commented, there are different takes of it too. Right? It's important to recognize where we are from, where we're coming from. And secondly, to have our own stability of the mind, our own clarity and steadiness to be able to sit with pain and deep, deep suffering here. And I think when we can allow that to happen, then real deep conversations start to occur. And that's my input then.
Thank you. I'll be quick. I just wanted to say thank you so much. I'm currently in hospital with depression, and I was let out for the weekend. But I really, it's very inspiring to see the deep compassion with which you are dealing with these issues and realizing the needs in others. And it's something I haven't seen very much of, but it's just so, it's always made so much sense to me. So I've always wondered where it was. So yeah, and someone that has come from, you know, doing a lot of Buddhist meditation and listening to Dharma, I have often questioned the control of my mind and whether there was something wrong with me that I often, or not, well, yeah, that I slip into this place that I can't seem to control. And so I really respect your answer in that it does, it is both. And I hope that I can still be a good practitioner along with dealing with these issues. And there was one last thing. Thank you, all of you, for helping me respect the illness that I have, because and the people around me, because I often have so much judgment for myself, and then by extension for others, because it's an illness that I do not fully understand. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for saying what you've just said. Thank you for the courage to share your suffering, your tears with us. And it is through what you say, the wisdom and the compassion in the way you deliver us, that not only helps you, it helps all of us. Thanks to you. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I think it was a good way to end with a courageous story. I would like to give my thanks as well, because it's very rare to hear someone being able to be so brave to tell their own stories, and particularly with that other lady up the top there about her child. So thank you again, and we'll take a morning tea break for about 10 minutes.